Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty is on assignment this week. Across the country, as they prepare to step out into the world on their own, college graduates have been listening to commencement speeches. Some of these speeches full of lofty rhetoric and sentiment, some of them funny, and many others forgettable. Well, here's one that hasn't been forgotten. 50 years ago, early June 1963, President John F. Kennedy delivered the commencement address at American University in Washington. He called it a strategy of peace, and it was a direct appeal to Americans and to the leaders of the Soviet Union in the height of the Cold War. Many historians consider it the best speech of his presidency.
And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
A strategy of peace was remarkable both in its departure from hostile Cold War rhetoric and its empathy toward the Soviet Union. It came just months after the two superpowers walked to the brink of nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy announced a unilateral above-ground nuclear test ban, called for better communication with the USSR, and a relaxation of tensions that would eventually lead to détente with the Soviet Union. Kennedy's appeal for peace was so direct and controversial that he kept the contents of the speech a closely guarded secret, even from members of his own cabinet. We're going to talk a little bit about this speech right now, and joining me now to help us with that is Ambassador Nicholas Burns. He's a retired diplomat, a professor at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He's also a columnist for Global Post. And Nicholas Burns, welcome to Radio Boston. It's very good to have you.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be with you.
And from Washington, D.C., Robert Schlesinger joins us. He's the son of Arthur Schlesinger, who served as a special assistant to the Kennedy White House. Robert Schlesinger is the author of The White House Ghosts, Presidents and Their Speechwriters. He's also a managing editor at U.S. News and World Report. And Robert Schlesinger, welcome to you as well. It's great to have both of you.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, let me start and pick up on some of these themes that I mentioned. The speech was unusual and dramatic for so many reasons. Dramatic because it was such a direct appeal for peace to a Cold War enemy. Unusual because of the way it was written and because it was so out of step with much of the thinking of that time. And let me start with that last point. And Nicholas Burns, let me start with you. Remind us of the context in which this speech was delivered.
Well, as you say, it was the height of the Cold War, 1963, kind of the epicenter of that five-decade struggle between the United States, NATO on the one hand, and the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact on the other. And Kennedy had, you know, a nearly disastrous first year in office in terms of national security and foreign policy. He bought into the Bay of Pigs, which was a disaster for him and for the country early in his presidency. He was taken to the cleaners by Khrushchev at the April 1961 summit in Vienna. There was the Berlin crisis, which a lot of people forget about now, of 1961, a near miss of a war between the United States and Soviet Union over Berlin. And as you say, then the crucible of the Cuban Missile Crisis, October 1962. So the backdrop of this speech is a perilous few years where the United States and Soviet Union nearly collided. And the consequences in the nuclear age would have been, who knows, in a nuclear exchange, 100 million, 150 million human beings killed in a nuclear conflict between these two superpowers. And Kennedy, I do think it's his greatest speech. I think it's the most important speech by an American president in the last 50 years on national security, because it's such a radical departure from conventional thinking. And it's filled with wisdom and insight into how we need to search for peace, not demonize our enemies, believe that peace is possible. Kennedy said in that speech, it's a dangerous defeatist belief to believe that we cannot have peace on in the world. And I think in the ultimate part of it was the clip that you just played, that wonderful, poetic, thoughtful, deeply thoughtful quote, "For in the final analysis, you know, we all breathe the same air." That to me, speaks very directly to our problems in 2013, 50 years later, of globalization.
So interesting.
Of the fact that we all share the earth, and therefore we all have to overcome problems together.
Well, Nicholas Burns, you put a lot on the table there. Robert Schlesinger, let me come to you. You write in your book how unusual it was in the way JFK wrote it, that it was very much a private collaboration between him and his speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, and they took pains not to share it with members of his own cabinet, with Secretary of State Dean Rusk, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. Why did they do it that way?
They didn't feel like they could trust. They had entire control over the bureaucracy, and they didn't feel like the bureaucracy was capable of producing a statement like this. They felt like there were times in the administration where the president had to not simply lead the country, but very specifically lead the parts of the government over which, you know, the institutional bureaucracy didn't feel like he necessarily had full control of it.
Mm. Well, let's hear a bit more of this speech at American University. Here's John F. Kennedy talking about the need for peace, and he really dips back into his own history, the history of his own generation, in making this direct appeal. Let's listen.
This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
John F. Kennedy talking about a strategy of peace 50 years ago. Listeners, we're talking about President JFK's commencement address to American University a half a century ago. What strikes you about this famous speech? Could you imagine hearing a speech like this from a president today or in this era? What questions do you have? We've got two great guests with us, former Ambassador Nicholas Burns and Robert Schlesinger, son of Special Assistant to President Kennedy, Arthur Schlesinger. Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Let me talk about some of the specifics. Robert Schlesinger, among other things, Kennedy unilaterally declared an end to atmospheric nuclear testing. He called for a direct hotline between Washington and Moscow. How was this speech received, first of all, here at home?
We know it's funny because we remember it as one of Kennedy's great speeches. But Kennedy looked at the White House account of how much mail that had come into the White House after the week after the speech, and of something like 50,000 pieces of mail, less than 1,000 had to do with the speech.
Hmm.
I mean, it was very. And Kennedy said, you know, this is. He told my father, this is why I tell people in Congress they're crazy if they pay attention to their mail.
don't pay attention to your mail, right? Yeah.
It was. I think well received at home. It was well received abroad. The real symbol of how well it was, how powerful a speech it was. Was that the Soviet Union, when the U.S. broadcast it into the Soviet Union, they initially only jammed one paragraph, which was unusual. They'd usually jam whole speeches or certainly much more. And then when the speech was rebroadcast, they let the whole speech be broadcast. And so that showed exactly what a powerful message it was and how important it was to the process going forward.
Yeah, and what kind of sense did we get from the Soviet Union about how it was received? I mean, do we even know exactly who heard it?
I don't know. We might. I do not. But mm-hmm. Certainly I think the fact that the Soviets allowed it to be broadcast in its fullness shows that they understood that it was an important message, and it was a sharp change of rhetoric from the West in terms of the question of peace.
Sure. Well, one of the themes, Nicholas Burns, that you brought up in this speech was this real effort to acknowledge the Soviet Union as a nation with a great history that had made great contributions to culture and science and that had suffered greatly during the war. Let's listen to one more clip here.
And no nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War. At least 20 million lost their lives. Countless millions of homes and families were burned or sacked. A third of the nation's territory, including two-thirds of its industrial base, was turned into a wasteland, a loss equivalent to the destruction of this country east of Chicago.
How significant, Nicholas Burns, how risky was it and how significant was it for JFK to really, I mean, he's really putting a human face on the Soviet Union there, right?
He was. And the message here, if you read this speech and better yet, as you've done, listen to it, it's very powerful. The message is we would be greatly mistaken if we demonize our adversaries, if we make them into subhuman people, that they are people just like us and that this particular adversary fought with us in the Second World War and suffered in a way that we could not even imagine. So that was a powerful part of the speech. It was risky for Kennedy. Remember, this was 1963. He was a first-term president. He was facing it turned out to be Barry Goldwater, who ran in 64 against LBJ, a very conservative Republican Party, which wanted to find evidence that JFK was weak on communism and weak on this huge threat that we face. So it was very risky. And I think another reason, as Robert has said, that why this speech was hidden from most of the cabinet and most of his influential advisors, this kind of change in one speech, as Robert said, could not have been brought about by a bureaucracy, by a team of people representing different agencies. It had to come from the person at the top who was willing to break free of conventional wisdom and really chart the country on a very different course, as JFK did with his speech.
It's amazing to hear this speech. I spent it's actually a relatively short speech. I think it takes about 20 minutes. I listened to the whole thing this morning, and it reads really well, too. And I wanted to ask you, Robert Schlesinger, about the oratorical style of this speech. What distinguishes it as a piece of political speechmaking?
Well, you see a lot of the classic Kennedy style. We don't want a strategy for destruction. Instead, we want a strategy for peace. That sort of contrast of terminology and options. It was written in close collaboration with his chief speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, who and Ted worked with a small group of people, mostly in the White House, including my father, who as we've discussed, kept it from the sort of top cabinet secretaries and the bureaucracy. But it was, you know, Kennedy always liked speeches that were, he didn't like flowery rhetoric, even though we think of ask not and the torch has been passed. He liked effective rhetoric, and he liked, you know, again, the sort of the contrasts and finding a middle way between, you know, Pax Americana and the peace of the grape, as he puts it in another part of the speech.
Yeah. Nicholas Burns, I was really struck by one of the lines. I mean, this isn't sort of one of the great lines, but it was just such a theme where he really challenges Americans to reexamine their own attitudes as individuals, as a nation. And I don't know, sitting here in 2013, I'm sort of amazed that a president could get away with that, because it's a dicey proposition to sort of say, hey, you need to think differently about the world out there.
Well, it's interesting you raise that, because, you know, we think sometimes of politicians that they are a bit craven, that they pander to what they think the public wants to hear. Kennedy was not giving the public what it wanted to hear in this speech. He was telling them that he and we all needed to think very differently about this stated adversary of the United States. And there's a point in the speech at the very end when he refers to the fact that there are human interests as well as national interests. And that evocation of human interests, I think, is remarkably prescient and remarkably modern, because if there's anything that defines our own time 50 years later, it's globalization. It's the fact that all the people of the world face certain problems together, like climate change. And I assign this speech to my students at the Kennedy School because I think it's very relevant for them to hear a political leader talk about all the world having to think alike in order for all the world to be successful and peaceful.
Could you, and Nicholas, let me ask you, I mean, just because you've been in government relatively recently, could you imagine a speech like this being delivered by a sitting U.S. president today? Could it happen?
The closest, if you think of our politics in 2013, if President Obama were to give a speech on Iran where he extolled the virtues of the Iranian people and Iranian history and said they're not our enemies and we've got to find a way to work with them and deal with them, he may have to give such a speech if we face, you know, war or peace with Iran. But it would be very risky It would play into the stereotypes that the Republican opposition has had for the president. It would be risky internationally as well, because not everyone around the world, in the Arab world, for instance, would want to have that kind of speech. So sometimes presidents, great presidents, use speeches as a way to really lead, to put a vision out there of a different world and to ask people to follow. And that's how I see JFK's speech of 50 years ago.
And same question to you, Robert Schlesinger. Could you imagine, was there something about that time and that particular president that allowed a speech like this to be born relative compared to today?
Yeah, I agree with everything Nicholas said, but I think it is important to really appreciate the context of the speech. You know, JFK was a certified cold warrior. His inaugural address, which we all remember and revere, was a Cold War statement through and through, hardly touched on domestic politics at all. And even 2 weeks after he gives the American University speech, he goes to Berlin and gives a thoroughly Cold War speech. He says, "Ich bin ein Berliner." He says, "People say we can coexist with the Soviet Union. We'll let them come to Berlin and see the Berlin Wall." And I think that shows you exactly, that even 2 weeks later, he was saying things that ran contrary to what he said at American University, showed you how in place the Cold War mentality was, and how much of a divergence from the conventional wisdom the speech was.
Mm. Listeners, in this season of commencement addresses, we're talking about a great one by President John F. Kennedy 50 years ago, almost to the day, his commencement speech at American University. What strikes you about this famous speech? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Vicky, who's calling from Wellesley. Hi, Vicky, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just wondering at this point, and you sort of, in a certain sense, touched on it just now, but, is there a chance that we can get our Senate and Congress to really move to a policy of peace and move to a policy of accepting differences rather than fighting them?
Vicky, a big question. Let's put it on the table there. Nicholas Burns, do you want to respond to Vicky?
Well, thanks to Vicky for calling from my hometown of Wellesley, Mass. This is a constant struggle. Presidents have a responsibility to defend the nation as well as to seek peace. And in any administration, you have this tension between wanting to have sufficient military force to protect our country, the people in it, the territory, and wanting to reach out and try to create a more peaceful world. They're not mutually exclusive. But there are times when presidents can reach out and say that peace is the highest priority. There are other times, say after 9/11, when security is clearly the highest priority. Getting the balance right is important, and that's what's remarkable about Kennedy's speech, because he didn't let down his guard. He didn't decrease defense spending. He kept American military power at its zenith, and yet he used that power, really combining diplomacy and military force, to reach out to the adversary. Sometimes when we're strong, it's easier to do that, and it's wiser to do it in that fashion.
I want to play one more cut from this speech just to keep Kennedy's voice present in this conversation. Here he is laying out a vision of a nuclear-free world that I guess you could say continues to elude us to this day.
Today, the expenditure of billions of dollars every year on weapons acquired for the purpose of making sure we never need them is essential to the keeping of peace. But surely the acquisition of such idle stockpiles, which can only destroy and never create, is not the only, much less the most efficient, means of assuring peace.
Robert Schlesinger, in 1963, the U.S. had about 25,000 nuclear weapons in its arsenal, the USSR something like 4,500. 2 years after that speech, the U.S. had more than 30,000. So I'm wondering if by that measure, was Kennedy's message not heard? At some level, did the speech not resonate?
Well, it's like what they say about turning a battleship or an aircraft carrier. You can't turn it on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
And you need a clear clarion message sort of to put a flag in the ground that you can rally around and over time get the change that you want.
Yeah. So it's going to take time. Right. Nicholas Burns, let me go to a caller before I come back with this next question to you, Nicholas. Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Fenway right here in Boston. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. I really appreciate the topic. I think there's something you've probably read. I believe the book is called Unspeakable, and or The Unspeakable, and it's quite a documentary evidence regarding what led to Kennedy's assassination. I think that the speeches he gave were all the more remarkable because I think he was quite cognizant of the risk he was taking in fighting the establishment and aiming towards peace as opposed to the adopting the standard Cold War mentality. I'm wondering if your commentators have anything to say about
sure.
that.
Sure. Yeah, Robert Schlesinger, did JFK, pick up on Dave's point, did JFK, was he aware of literally a mortal risk in making a speech like this?
Well, I think generally speaking, at times he was aware of either political or personal risks. I'm not sure that he ever said, I doubt he ever made a specific connection between this speech and the risk of assassination.
Hmm. Nicholas Burns, the question I was right on the verge of asking you a moment ago is that you've talked about this as really being one of the great presidential speeches. What other speech comes close? I mean, since Kennedy, I mean, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush 2, Obama, is there one or two speeches along the way that comes close in terms of impact and legacy, in your view?
You know, Robert might have a better view of this than me because he studies this. I don't see one that comes as close. And part of the brilliance of his speech is its clarity 50 years later.
Mm.
And so there may be a George H.W. Bush or Barack Obama speech out there 50 years later that's so prescient and so wise that people, our grandchildren, will say that was a great speech. I do think that President Obama's takes speeches more seriously than many of his predecessors and uses them as a device to lead, to chart the way forward. He's a very thoughtful person, whether you agree with him or not. He's thoughtful. His speeches are deeply reflective. The speech he gave last week was remarkable in its complexity, the one about Guantanamo and how to fight the war on terror. So I think maybe the speech, I'm struggling now to find one, that comes to mind is President Obama's Nobel Prize speech in December 2009 when he played against form, when he went to the heart of Europe, the heart of liberal Europe, Oslo, and said, there is such thing as just war, and we have to have a strong military, and we have to be willing to fight for what we believe. And that ran counter to perhaps why the Europeans gave him the Nobel Prize in the first place. That was a courageous speech and a very beautiful speech as well.
Mm. Well, Robert Schlesinger, last question to you in the sort of 20 seconds that remains. Is there a close second here to JFK's American University speech?
I think, the Obama speech is one that pops to mind. Eisenhower's farewell address, where he warns against the military-industrial complex, comes to mind. Not my ideological cup of tea, but Reagan's speech at Westminster to the Parliament in 1982, where he talked about how the Soviet Union would end, I think is an important speech. But I think 50 years later, JFK is still on top.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Robert Schlesinger, author of White House Ghosts, Presidents and Their Speechwriters, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And Nicholas Burns, former Ambassador Nicholas Burns, will be part of a panel discussion at the JFK Library tonight, which will examine the American University speech. Ambassador Burns, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Coming up, a Berkeley professor leaves his drums in the classroom to capture the sounds of Cape Cod. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.